This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. It was a year ago today that President Obama sat down at a borrowed desk in a Denver museum and signed the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. It was a massive government stimulus program designed to jumpstart the ailing economy. A year later, the economy is working again, but millions of Americans are not. The mixed track record of the stimulus has shaken confidence in the administration, even as the president pushes for more measures to add jobs. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
The economic stimulus was the first big challenge of the Obama administration and its first big achievement. Even before Mr. Obama was sworn in, he was urging lawmakers to act swiftly and boldly, opening the government's checkbook to fill a gaping economic hole. The president signed the $787 billion measure just 4 weeks after taking office.
I don't want to pretend that today marks the end of our economic problems, nor does it constitute all of what we're going to have to do to turn our economy around. But today does mark the beginning of the end, the beginning of what we need to do to create jobs for Americans scrambling in the wake of layoffs.
In a phrase that foreshadowed the ambiguity of stimulus results, the president said the measure would create or save some 3.5 million jobs over the next 2 years.
And we expect you, the American people, to hold us accountable for the results.
Both the White House and the Congressional Budget Office say so far, thanks to the stimulus, something like 2 million people are working who otherwise wouldn't be. But that's like trying to climb up a down escalator. Unemployment still topped 10% last year, and there are some 3 million fewer people working now than when the president raised his stimulus pen. On the other hand, the economy, which had been shrinking at a rapid rate, is growing again, and monthly job losses have slowed to a trickle. Christina Romer, who chairs the president's Council of Economic Advisers, says the stimulus deserves credit for arresting the economic freefall.
Remember back to what it was like a year ago when we were losing almost 800,000 jobs a month, when we were seeing GDP plummeting rather than rising as it has for the last two quarters.
Private economists largely agree the stimulus has helped to cushion the recession's blow, but the general public is not convinced. And Republican lawmakers, who almost unanimously oppose the stimulus, happily encourage those doubts. A poll by the Pew Research Center found more people think Mr. Obama's policies have worsened the economy than made it better. One explanation for this underwhelming appraisal is that the stimulus just wasn't big enough to combat a recession that so far has claimed nearly 8.5 million jobs. Romer reportedly believed a year ago that a bigger stimulus was needed, but she says the White House took what Congress would allow.
I think we did what we could, and it was very effective. I think what the president is talking about now is we need to do more, because he does think the American people deserve that.
Politics drove not only the size of the stimulus, but also its shape, with a heavy reliance on tax cuts, even though direct government spending is generally thought to deliver more economic bang for the buck.
About a third of this package comes in the forms of tax cuts, by the way, the most progressive in our history. Not only spurring job creation, but putting money in the pockets of 95% of hardworking families in America.
But 95% of American families don't think they got a tax cut. In fact, according to a new CBS poll, only 12% of Americans believe Mr. Obama cut their taxes. Instead of going out in a highly visible lump sum check, this cut simply left a little more money in workers' paychecks. Behavioral economists say that's the best way to encourage people to spend their stimulus rather than stashing it away. But White House spokesman Robert Gibbs admits any political payoff was lost.
Would I have liked to hire somebody to knock on everyone's door, you know, like the publisher of Clearinghouse guys and the big check and the balloons and the TV cap? Sure, maybe it would have had a greater effect.
The administration is still paying a price for its marketing missteps. Rightly or wrongly, the president's first big initiative is widely seen as missing the mark. And that perception has made everything Mr. Obama tried to do since the stimulus that much harder. Scott Horsley, NPR News, the White House.
You can see snapshots of the stimulus and how it's affected people across America at npr.org.
One of the U.S. economy's biggest problems is jobs, or a lack of them. The economy has been growing for more than half a year, but employers keep cutting jobs, and the unemployment rate is still high. As NPR's Jim Zaroli reports, this kind of hiring lag is by no means unusual.
At Quadrant Plastic Products in Reading, Pennsylvania, employees in goggles and blue T-shirts stand hunched over their workstations. The building dates to Victorian times, but the factory floor is a noisy sea of high-tech manufacturing equipment, churning out customized plastics. A few years ago, business was booming, and Quadrant took on new workers, says process technician Dave Wagner.
But then just like that, the recession hit, and we sort of had to turn these guys out then. That was really tough to do because the guys are really coming up to speed, the newer ones, and we had a lot of good prospects here, but it was a shame we had to let them go.
For a while, business dropped off, but orders began picking up last year. Quadrant has rehired some people and restored workers' hours. But spokesman Chris Schwartz says the company, whose customers include medical equipment and semiconductor manufacturers, isn't taking on any new workers.
When we see growth in those industries, we'll step up.
And you just don't see that kind of long-term growth at this point?
As an organization, we use all sorts of tools to try and see what each of those specific industry segments is doing, and they all have wonderful indicators, and all those indicators show some growth, but not a level of growth that would require us to knock out a wall and add on to the facility.
Quadrant is waiting to see whether the economic rebound is for real before it hires. That's pretty typical as recessions end. Economist Diane Swank of Mesirow Financial says even when companies do start hiring, they do it gradually.
What they do initially is work their existing labor force longer hours, add on, you know, additional overtime hours, and then they finally, when they feel confident enough that the recovery they're seeing is real, they actually dip their toe and make the commitment into the pool of hiring.
The result is a hiring lag, and there's a lot of precedent for it. The last recession ended in November 2001. Unemployment kept rising until June 2003, when it hit 6.3%. The recession before that ended in March 1991, but unemployment didn't peak for 15 months. It was a huge political headache for then-President Bush, who had to convince a skeptical public that things really were improving.
I would say it just shows that the economy, the recovery, which we're in, is not as robust as I'd like to see it.
Today, Democrats are in virtually the same position, waiting for job growth that history suggests is bound to come eventually. How long it will take to get here is a matter of some debate. Economist Lakshman Ashathan of the Economic Cycle Research Institute says the job market has already begun to recover about 6 months after the recession ended.
That's much, much faster than you saw jobs growth coming out of the last two recessions, where it took well over a year. The last recession, it took 21 months till you had sustained positive jobs growth. We're going to have that right here at the beginning of 2010.
Others are more skeptical. Economist Sean Snaith of the University of Central Florida says there are still a lot of lingering problems confronting the economy, a wave of mortgage foreclosures, uncertainty about taxes and federal regulation, and a weak commercial real estate market.
With all of these things going on, you know, the right thing, the right response for these bankers is really just to hunker down and to sandbag and to try to wait out the storm as opposed to get out there and start freely lending once again.
As a result, credit is harder to get, which is especially tough on small businesses that create a lot of jobs. The good news is that companies are doing more temporary hiring and employees are working longer hours. Traditionally, those are harbingers of a job recovery. But as long as employers remain skittish about their prospects, that recovery will probably be a weak one. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block. The government is on pace to set another red ink record for the year. According to the Treasury Department, the government ran a deficit of more than $430 billion over the last 4 months. President Obama says in the short run, it's important for the government to keep spending borrowed money. But ultimately, he says the government has to get back to fiscal responsibility. And to that end, the president will sign an executive order tomorrow setting up a bipartisan commission to recommend budget fixes. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
President Obama said in his weekly radio address, the nation's budget problems were years in the making. And the only way to solve them is to put politics aside and make hard choices. Not exactly a Washington strong suit these days.
The American people are tired of politicians who talk the talk, but don't walk the walk when it comes to fiscal responsibility. It's easy to get up in front of the cameras and rant against exploding deficits. What's hard is actually getting deficits under control.
So hard, in fact, neither Congress nor the president want to tackle the challenge on their own. Alice Rivlin, who managed the White House Budget Office during the Clinton administration, says the government's long-term fiscal outlook is now so far out of balance, it will take some heavy lifting to correct it.
It can't be done all on the spending side, and it can't be done all on the revenue side. It's going to take both, and that's been the political problem.
Congressional Democrats won't cut spending on Medicare or Social Security, which largely drive future deficits. And Republicans won't raise taxes. Douglas Holtz-Aiken, who ran the Congressional Budget Office and advised John McCain's presidential campaign, says the only way to break this stalemate is for both parties to give ground.
The things you have to do to control the fiscal outlook, which are reduce spending in places that it's popular and raise taxes in places where it's unpopular, are politically unpalatable. And so to have both parties hold hands and do it at the same time is really the key.
The bipartisan commission the president's setting up tomorrow could be a vehicle for that kind of compromise. Mr. Obama decided to order the commission after a similar panel he supported, proposed by Senators Kent Conrad and Judd Gregg, failed to pass the Senate. Unlike the Conrad-Gregg panel, the president's commission would have no power to force Congress into action. But Rivlin says it might still make a difference.
If the president can get very good people on the commission, he may be able to shame both parties into working together.
The president spoke last week with Republican congressional leaders about naming members to his commission. Mr. Obama himself named a Republican co-chair, former Wyoming Senator Alan Simpson. White House spokesman Robert Gibbs says Simpson's appointment should carry some weight.
I think he is somebody who has dealt with many of these issues throughout his tenure in Washington in a serious way. What the Republicans decide to do is largely up to them.
New Hampshire Republican Judd Gregg is still smarting that his own idea for a congressional deficit commission failed in the Senate. He's doubtful Mr. Obama's commission will do much to improve the nation's fiscal situation.
Well, you obviously can discuss the issues and you can have a report. There's been a lot of commissions over the years that have done this. I've served on two of them. They both came up with very substantive and thoughtful approaches as to how you get our fiscal house in order. Unfortunately, in both instances, there was no follow-up.
In the end, Gregg says, lawmakers are better at considering the next election than the next generation. Scott Horsley, NPR News, The White House.
These are tough times for state governments. Many of them are contending with huge budget deficits, and a report issued today says there's a daunting challenge just ahead. Many states have promised big pension and retirement benefits to their employees without putting aside money to pay for them. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
The report was put out by the Pew Center on the States, and it portrays a state pension system that's headed for crisis if it's not already there. Susan Uran is the center's managing director.
The 50 states have racked up more than $3.3 trillion in long-term liabilities for pensions, health care, and other retirement benefits that they promised to their current employees and retirees. But they have not got any money set aside to pay $1 trillion, which is almost a third of this bill.
Uran says states often try to compensate for relatively low salaries by offering their employees generous retirement benefits, and they can be very generous. Connecticut has a series of early retirement programs that allow employees with 10 years of service to retire at age 52. Politicians can get away with this because the bill won't come due till after they've left office. Orrin Kramer heads the New Jersey Investment Council.
It's an easy omission, because if you underfund, you're passing costs on to future generations of taxpayers, but that isn't going to be obvious for a long time.
The report says almost all state pension plans are underfunded. Two states, Illinois and Kansas, have set aside less than 60% of the money they'll need to pay benefits. Six others are underfunded by a third or more. The Pew Center's Susan Uran says the problem has been exacerbated by the recession, which has cut into the value of state investment funds. But Uran says states have underfunded their plans even in good times.
This matters tremendously, because how well states manage their retirement costs affects how much money they have to spend on other priorities. And in fact, these costs are already adding significant pressure to already stressed state budgets.
Uran says states that underfund their pension plans have to make up for it later. She compares what happened to two neighboring states, New York and New Jersey. Until 2002, both kept their pension plans adequately funded. But then New Jersey stopped making regular payments. Much like someone who keeps using a credit card while paying only the minimum each month, New Jersey has now seen its liabilities soar.
Fast forward up to 2008. Now New Jersey's annual bill is $1 billion more than New York's, even though its total pensions liability is $15 billion less. So that's the impact of simply kicking the can down the road.
And she says many states may be in worse shape than they appear because they use an accounting technique called smoothing. They average out the value of their investments over 5 years or so, which tends to obscure the depth of their losses in times when the financial markets have taken a hit, like they have in recent years. But the report also says it's not too late for states to get their houses in order. Simple changes made now, like raising the retirement age by just a year, can make a big difference over time. But that will require some tough choices by state officials, and that's something many of them have shied away from. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
To see whether your state has high or low funding levels for its pension plans, go to npr.org.